The poet William Ernest Henley famously concludes one of his poems this way: "I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." This is a perspective that claims that mankind is utterly in control in spite of life circumstances. Others look at the wild circumstances at certain points in life and wonder how it all came about. Would they call it chance or luck? Would they call it fate? Many great thinkers and people throughout history have pondered the mystery of what person or force most directs the course of our lives. But this doesn't have to be a mystery for any one of us. The God of the Bible is absolutely unique. Reading through the Bible reveals this fact, even if one reads in smaller portions. In fact, the God of the Bible is so unique that even a book of the Bible where God isn't mentioned by name is filled with the evidence of His guiding hand. In today's program, Pastor Paul Tauchus phrases the truth this way from the book of Esther. Even a casual reading of it reveals that there's no such thing as a coincidence. There's no such thing as chance. Instead, there is the invisible hand of God guiding by His providence. We invite you to join us now as Pastor Paul Tauchus continues this series, From Garden to Garden, teaching us about the Bible's grand story of redemption. His message is titled, The Invisible Hand of Providence. Let's open our Bibles to the book of Esther as we together delight in the Word.
A holiday means so much more when you understand the history behind it. Whether it's Memorial Day or Independence Day or Thanksgiving or any other of our national holidays, once you realize how that holiday came into existence and why it's celebrated, it means so much more. The same is true when it comes to Jewish holidays. They mean more when you understand the history behind them. So I want to read a portion of the book of Esther this morning to introduce you to one of the Jewish holidays that we don't often think of. So open to Esther chapter 9. If you're wondering where Esther is, it comes after Ezra and Nehemiah. Whether that helps or not, I'm not sure. But that is where you'll find it. Esther chapter 9 and verse 20. And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month Adar and also the 15th day of the same year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness, and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast lots, to crush and destroy them. But when it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that his evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore they called these days Purim, after the term pure. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter, and of what they had faced in this matter, and of what had happened to them, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written and at the time appointed every year, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, in every clan, province, and city, and that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew gave full written authority confirming this second letter about Purim. Letters were sent to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus in words of peace and truth, that these days of Purim should be observed at their appointed seasons, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them, and as they had obligated themselves and their offspring with regard to their fasts and their lamenting. The command of Queen Esther confirmed these practices of Purim, and it was recorded in writing. This is the Feast of Purim, instituted at the end of the Book of Esther. As you noticed in the text, that Purim literally means lots. It comes from the word pur, and gets its name from the way the wicked Haman had cast lots to determine on what day the Jewish race ought to be annihilated. The Feast of Purim commemorates the saving of the Jewish people, which is not the first time. It's not the first time that Satan in biblical history has sought to destroy the Jewish people, and it's not the first time that God has saved them. That's really what's behind the Book of Esther. There's a war. There's a spiritual war going on between Satan and God. You remember in the book of Genesis, when God cursed the serpent in the garden, he promised that the seed of the woman would one day come to crush his head. And so since then, Satan has been doing everything in his power to sever the human line that would fulfill that promise. Through murder, through rebellion, through famine and slavery, through the divided kingdom, through Saul's attempts to murder David, through Joseph's brothers and their hatred for him, and on it goes. The redemption story in the book of Esther is similar to the true story of God saving Israel through the ministry of Joseph, through his suffering, through his elevation to a place of prominent political leadership. But the book of Esther is very different than the story of Joseph, in that God's involvement is kept hidden in the darkness. His involvement is hidden in the shadows, in the background. And that's what makes the book of Esther so unique. It's the only book of the Bible where God's name is not mentioned. There's simply no acknowledgement of his presence in an upfront way. And yet, his sovereignty and his providence is revealed on every page. Even a casual reading of it reveals that there's no such thing as a coincidence. There's no such thing as chance. Instead, there is the invisible hand of God guiding by his providence. The book's events silently support the claims of other scripture that God is sovereign and he is directing all things toward the fulfillment of his plan. Now, the events of the book of Esther take place at the time of the Jewish exile, but in the kingdom of Persia. And I want you to see this morning the invisible hand of God revealed in the book of Esther. And I want you to notice how God's hand of providence governs four areas of our lives. Number one, the invisible hand of God's providence governs the demotion and elevation of political leaders. Chapter 1, the opening scene of this drama takes place in the palace of the king of Persia. Verse 1 says, "Now in the days of Ahasuerus," the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, "in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants." So Ahasuerus, or Xerxes I, he's also known as. He decides to give a banquet for all of his officials and his servants, but this was not your average party. It lasted 6 months long, and the guests received an unlimited supply of wine. The six-month feast for the king's servants is then followed by a seven-day feast for all who lived in the city of Susa, the capital of Persia. And on top of the king's feast, the queen also gives a feast. We see that in verse 9. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. But then trouble enters the picture. Verse 10, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded, Bizda, Harbona, Bigtha. You pregnant ladies should just close your ears. Don't get any ideas from these names. Zithar and Carcass. The seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus. To bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. So the king wants to show off the beauty of his queen. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. The beautiful Queen Vashti refuses the drunken king's request. And now there is trouble. She rebels. She refuses to come at his command. And so the king has a real problem on his hands. What is he to do? The king's wise men then enter the picture, and they say, well, that if he does nothing, then all the women of the kingdom will also be disrespectful toward their husbands. And so the king issues a decree stating that Queen Vashti is forever to be deposed and that every man should be the head of his house. So that's what happens. Vashti is demoted, and now a new queen must be found. And so the king's young men encourage him to host a beauty pageant to find Miss Persia. And we find this recorded in chapter 2 and verse 3. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them. And let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This pleased the king, and he did so. And so now enters onto the stage Esther, the heroine of the book. Verse 5, now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther. Hadassah is her Hebrew name. It means myrtle tree. The daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of this man who had the charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly provided her with cosmetics and her portion of food, and with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. And as somewhat of a parenthesis, verse 10 lets us know that Esther has not yet made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. So she kept the fact that she was Jewish a secret. And so out of these women, Esther is selected. She is given 7 personal attendants, because even though she is one of the most beautiful women in the kingdom, she still needs 12 months of cosmetics. This is Mary Kay on steroids. I'm pretty sure Botox was invented in Persia. But after a year at the spa, Esther goes to the harem's closet. She gets to choose any clothing she wants, whatever jewelry she wants, to prepare herself to meet the king, to present herself to the king. And so we pick it up in verse 16 of chapter 2, when it says, "And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." So Esther is now the queen of Persia. Vashti has been demoted. Esther has been promoted, elevated to that position. And it's no small coincidence that she's Jewish. And this is the first way we see the invisible hand of God's providence in the book of Esther. We see how God governs over the demotion of leaders and the elevation of leaders. So, is there application in this for us? Well, there's a whole lot of application. For example, if you tend to lose sleep over the state of current affairs or get anxious about upcoming elections, then rest assured, God is in control. Though he works in and through his people and processes, the end results are his. For example, Proverbs 16:33 says, "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." The votes are cast on Tuesday, and the end result is the decision of the Lord. Daniel 2:21 says, "He changes times and seasons. He removes kings, and he sets up kings." Or Psalm 66, verse 7, "God rules by his might forever. His eyes keep watch on all the nations. Let not the rebellious exalt themselves." And so the invisible hand of God governs over the affairs of the world, demoting some leaders and raising up others as part of his plan. There's a second way we see the invisible hand of providence, and that is that God governs over the timing of seemingly insignificant events. Pick it up in chapter 2, verse 19. "Now when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, 2 of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king." And so Esther's older cousin and father figure saves the king's life by thwarting an assassination attempt. But all is forgotten. And Mordecai goes back into the shadows. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And so now enters Haman, the antagonist in this drama. He is an Agagite, that is, he's a descendant of King Agag, who Saul was commanded to kill in 1 Samuel 15, but didn't. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him, but Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. And so here's Haman, who hates Mordecai because Mordecai refuses to bow down to him. And when he finds out that Mordecai is a Jew, his hatred goes beyond Mordecai to his entire kinship. See, before Hitler, there was Haman. Filled with fury against Mordecai, Haman plots now to kill every Jew. And chapter 3 then goes on to reveal him plotting. And all of this takes place 4 years after Esther has become queen. And so she's been on the throne for a little, but still her identity is unknown. And so basically Haman's plan consists of presenting the Jews as a rebellious group who is a threat to the king. And he offers 10,000 talents of silver to the king if he will agree to let him do whatever he wants to the Jews. The king refuses the bribe, but he gives him the authority. He gives him his signet ring, which was the ring of the king. It was the ring that was used to make a stamp, an impression in soft clay on an official government document. And so Haman now had the power and authority of the king to kill the Jews. And so he sends letters to all the provinces in the kingdom, informing them that on the 13th day of the 12th month, or on March 13th, all the Jews should be slaughtered on one day. And Mordecai hears of the demonic news, and he goes into mourning. And so in chapter 4, we see Mordecai weeping in sackcloth and ashes at the king's gate, and Esther's maids see him and go back to the queen and report what's going on. And now the queen is in a predicament. Even though she is the queen, Esther cannot simply waltz into the king's presence. She just can't do that. She must wait until she is summoned by the king. To go into the king's presence uninvited would result in her losing her pretty little head. That was the punishment. But Mordecai challenges her to think about why she has been put in this position. And he speaks then the key verses in the book. "For if you keep silent at this time," he says, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Listen, and then Mordecai says this to Esther, and who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. That's verse 14 of chapter 4.
The story of Esther is remarkable. From major world figures like kings and nations to the smallest events in our everyday lives, God's providence is at work. The same God who guided the story of Esther is at work in our day as well. If you'd like to listen again, you can find the program on our website at delightintheword.org, or you can find the program where you listen to your podcasts. This program has been brought to you by Cornerstone Community Church in Mayfield Heights, Ohio. We look forward to next time as Pastor Paul Tauches concludes this two-part message from the book of Esther. May the Lord bless you until next time as we together delight in the Word.